You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm joined by a very excellent newer comic. You might be aware of Nish Kumar from his last three great Edinburgh shows. You might have seen him in his brilliant double act with Tom Neenan, the Gentleman of Leisure, the old GOL, as well as Nish's more recent appearance on Stuart Lee's Alternative Comedy Experience for Comedy Central. And as you're about to hear, it's all going off. Here's Nish Kumar. Where shall we start? You are enjoying a glittering ascendancy at the moment, it seems to me. You described to me the other day your plans for the next year. Just tell us what your plans for the next year are.
I am supporting Milton Jones on tour for 2 months, and then I go straight off the back of that into New Zealand. And then by the time I come back from doing New Zealand, I will be prepping for Edinburgh. That's it.
You're back like a week ago from the Melbourne Roadshow tour of India.
Of India, yeah. So I've been to some places, Stuart.
Kumar's doing pretty well, right?
Kumar's travelling the world. Kumar's travelling the world. I just need that to start relating into some sweet, sweet cheddar, so that I can start so that I can start buying gold watches and chains with dollar signs on the end of them.
Does it feel like you're in a good place at the moment? Does it feel like this is a particularly good year you've got ahead of or behind you? I mean, you had your third great Edinburgh on the trot.
It's been a good year. I did Melbourne and I had a good Edinburgh. It's been a long year. It's been a long time coming.
Has it? Well, tell me about that. Does it feel like it has? Because something you said, we were chatting the other night and you were talking about doing a regular gig in, was it Balham or somewhere?
Yeah, it was the exhibit in Balham. Much loved. I think people still run gigs there, but the gig I'm talking about was run by PJ, who we're getting very much into the minutiae of the South London open mic circuit. But PJ is a kind of vaguely legendary figure in South London, and he gave a lot of people stage time. And so there's this tremendous number of people who owe him a lot, ranging from me and Daniel Simonson to Milton Jones and Al Murray.
Yeah.
But he used to run a gig in the exhibit bar in Balham on a Sunday night and a Monday night. And that there was a group of us who would go there pretty much every week because it was the only place we could get regular stage time. And the group of us was me, Daniel Simonson, Louisa O'Melan, Susie Ruffle, John Kearns, Pat Cahill, John Kearns, Sons, Wig and Teeth as well.
Back
when little Johnny Kearns was a clean-shaved, nice young boy. And there were Matt Hyten, and there were various people sort of around there, Chris Martin, there were various people around that gig at that time. And yeah, it was the conversation we were having was people would sort of get picked up by agents, and people would sort of come less frequently to that gig because they were getting other paid work. And it definitely got to a point where I was like, I think I might be gigging here every Sunday for the rest of my life.
So you've been going for how long?
Well, this is always an interesting question to ask people because there tend to be a couple of different answers. I started doing any comedy of any sort when I was at university. So I did 2 years of the Durham Review with Ed Gamble and Tom Neenan, and a couple of our other friends. So I did two Edinburghs there. And in my final year of university, Ed and Tom set up a stand-up night in Durham. And I did my first gigs there. So that would be possibly the back end of 2006 and maybe into 2007. Then I moved to London and I only really started on the open mic circuit in 2008. So there's a couple of different answers to that question.
Yes, okay. I think of myself as having been going for 10 years, but I've been saying that for so often it's probably 11 now or even 12. I think it's 10 or 11. And I certainly have sort of started to... I've gone through versions of, oh, it's all happening. And, oh, absolutely nothing's happening.
Yeah.
I was wrong.
Yeah.
But it feels like there's enough things happening for you at the moment in terms of the sort of the international travel and the Stuart Lee's comedy show that you were on.
Yeah.
I forget the name of the one.
It's the Alternative Comedy Experience, yeah.
So it feels like there are enough building blocks in place now that there will be, that it's become inevitable. Does it feel like that to you? Or does it feel like you're going, okay, there's a bit and a thing there, and maybe I can turn this into...
Yeah, it feels much more like that. It feels like I'm surviving month to month in a weird way. It feels like I don't think I'm particularly conscious of any momentum building. The thing that I feel good about is I think in the last year, I've probably produced the best stuff I've ever produced.
Yes, and so, I come to this conversation having just like an hour ago finished listening to the hour of your last,
yes,
your most recent Edinburgh show, Ruminations on the Nature of Subjectivity.
Correct.
Which is a title that works well when you see it next to a poster of you holding a pretentious pose, but one would assume when you don't see that poster, it just looks pretentious.
Oh, look, the whole concept was flawed. The concept was fundamentally flawed. I took a very stupid publicity shot in 2013 because Idil Sukan does all my publicity photos, our friend, does all of our publicity, and an incredible photographer, does all of my publicity shots. And both of the years, so from 2012, my first show, and then 2013, I quite enjoy deliberately messing with her and trying to put her off while she's a professional, because that's how I entertain myself. And I took a photo of myself, and she took a photo of me with my fingers up my nose, because she tried to get me to do a serious sort of look slightly off into the middle distance. And we thought nothing of it, and she included it in the press pack she sent my agent as a joke. And we saw the picture and thought, great, this is brilliant. We should definitely use this at some point for something. And it was such a stupid photo, I wanted to put a really pretentious title to it, because I immediately saw the poster. The poster looks like a kind of 1960s National Theatre thing. And yeah, it has a really dumb...
That's very... It does exactly, but I hadn't noticed that when I was looking at it. It did all that programming on me without knowing how.
Very specific series of images that we... So Idil and I then went through all of these posters. The 60s National Theatre had a sort of Bolshevik aesthetic where it's just very functional. Like, there's a serious photo and the title of a serious play in black and white, so you know that it's serious. And I wanted that photo, a big, heavy, pretentious title, and I was like, great, that's the poster. And then, of course, when you get to Edinburgh, there's lots of places where that photo does not appear. So a lot of people just thought I had got a little too big for my boots.
I wonder if that worked in a positive way in terms of your audience, because, like, if you'd called the show...
Tits and Charlie.
Yeah, yeah. If you called the show Tits and Charlie and had a sensible poster,
yeah,
that the joke would have worked.
Yeah.
But you might have had people turning up looking for Tits and Charlie.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas presumably your way around, at least you had intelligent people.
I had no problem with drunk people. I had one drunk guy.
Yeah, it would be the foolhardy stag do.
Yeah. It was. I had one guy who came in, and he was this kind of older posh guy who had been hitting the Merlots a little hard that afternoon, and he was a little bit disruptive. But other than that, I had no problem. Because, yeah, what kind of group of pissed up lads thinks, I'll tell you what, ruminations on the nature of subjectivity would be the perfect aperitif for our evening at the strip club.
I mean, even if they thought, even if one of them had gone, yeah, let's go and ruin the potential show, there's no way the others would have agreed to that.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah.
So, well, I want to talk to you about intelligence. You were called, I think you were called fiercely intelligent in some review or other. I have no business of quoting reviews particularly. But, I've just listened to your show, and I agree that it is your best show. And having not seen it, you know, I've seen your other shows sometimes more than once.
Yeah.
This one I've just heard the audio of and only just now. But it is incredibly, it has intelligence and it has emotional intelligence. Which of those qualities do you think is more important to you? It's intended to be a jumping off point rather than something where you go, the first one.
I got that. I got that sense. It's like when we used to get essay questions at university and you're like, whatever you do, don't just write true underneath the statement. The reason I'm not pausing is because the only thing Stuart said to me off microphone was, if you feel like you're about to say, I'm sorry, this is going to be a bit pretentious, just press on with it. So I'm trying to jump that step in my head. I think that they are both important to me because I like to do material that I guess would be considered cerebral. But at the same time, I think it's important to balance that with emotional intelligence. I think it's just the comedy I really like will often be people being very cutting about the world around them. And it's also important to me because those people that I really like are cutting about the world around them, but they are also very cutting about their own flaws. So they're as aware of their own weaknesses as they are of the weaknesses of the people or institutions they are targeting. So, and I think that it's important if you're going to show insight about external affairs and other people's flaws, you need to have insight about your own flaws as well. I think that you can't just go, this guy's full of shit, bang bang bang, joke, I'm perfect. Like, I think that for me that would be a slightly empty experience if the whole show was just about, only because if I was perfect and perfect emotionally stable, kind, generous person, I'd be perfectly happy calling people out on their bullshit and then ending the show there. You guys all suck, my name's Nish, good night, and just walk off. Whereas I am acutely aware of my own flaws. So it's important as much to me to highlight them as it is to highlight any problems I might have with other people.
Do you recognise that as a particularly British attribute?
I guess traditionally we'd call it pretty British, but at the same time, some of the comedians I'm thinking of are American, who would be. I'm thinking of someone like Louis C.K., who is very self-deprecating and aware of his own limitations. So I think traditionally we would think of it as being a British trait, but I actually think I think a lot of national stereotypes are self-perpetuating. You know, we think of this thing as being British, so when it happens, we say, oh, this is incredibly British.
Sure.
Ignoring a swathe of evidence.
Sure, but I think looking at what you just said a moment ago, which is like, you know, I tend to prefer material that could be considered cerebral.
Yeah.
I can't really imagine Louis C.K. saying that sentence. Do you know what I mean? I don't just mean self-deprecating. I mean, there is, like, you are a particularly British man.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the comic that I would most, funnily enough, and I know you well, and I know that you you've got a real horn for American comedy. Like, you love loads of American comedy. I don't know where I just got the phrase, you've got a horn.
I've got a horn. You know me, always masturbating whilst listening to some Bob Newhart albums.
The scaly horned Nishka. But in terms of your influences, or in terms of I was listening to you going, oh, there's, I'm sort of, you know, hearing echoes of other tones, other comics tones and stuff, not in a pejorative way. But
here's the dirty little secret about that. Always rip off people who are a different race to you. If you rip off somebody who is a different race to you, no one will ever know.
Ah, amazing!
The number of people, white 20-something comedians, who are being accused of ripping off Stuart Lee is eye-watering. And it's really obvious. If you're an Asian guy, make sure you rip off Stuart Lee. Because the world will just go, wow, I'm nuts.
I don't think there's anything... I don't think you remotely like Stuart Lee. I was going to say John Oliver.
Yeah, well... Yeah,
I know you're a huge fan. Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I'm not saying, hey man, you're ripping off John Oliver.
No.
I think that is... That's the voice that I most... And it's interesting that you should go, oh, someone of a different ethnicity. Yeah. Nailed it. But... Let's put that to one side, because I think there's lots of stuff to talk about there. But I'm mindful of the fact that people outside of the places you've gigged and some of the global places you've gigged who might be listening to this won't know you. So what sorts of... When we're talking about your material, when we're talking about a Nish Kumar set or show, what sort of things can we expect to see?
There will be pure truth. There will be some stuff about race, probably, and some stuff about... And there'll be some long words, and there'll be some pretty high-octane insecurity. Yeah, there'll be some long words, and there'll be some pretty high-octane insecurity. That would be my race... insecurity, vocabulary. Bang.
And the internet. You're quite fond of the internet, do you think?
I have a complicated relationship with the internet. I would say my relationship with the internet has never been... Yeah, I have a complicated relationship with contemporary culture because I'm a mass consumer of it, and at the same time, I'm somewhat ambivalent about its effects. Like, the end of my show this year is... I don't want to give too much away, I guess. But the end of the show is basically an analysis of whether the internet is ruining our brains. And my second show was about being turned into a meme.
And which people listening to this can Google. Confused Muslim.
Yeah, a publicity shot from my debut show, Who Is Nish Kumar? Brackets, 3 stars, solid effort. I don't know why I always feel the need to caveat that.
Very, very British, Nish.
Very British, yeah. Yeah. My first show, Who Is Nish Kumar, which opened to rave reviews at the Edinburgh Festival, a publicity shot from that was turned into a meme called The Confused Muslim.
And I should point out, it's not the only confused Muslim meme available. Because,
that's right, yeah.
There are some much more... I mean, you're not a Muslim, that was kind of the point. Yeah. One of the points of the show.
Yeah.
There are... I'm sure that there are kind of headdress-wearing... versions of that meme out there that people shouldn't Google and go, oh, that's what Nish Kumar looks like, necessarily.
Yeah. Somebody, I still don't know who did it. I've talked about it on stage extensively and on television, and I've covered it in some detail, and yet no one has stepped forward. Somebody took my picture and made it into a meme called The Confused Muslim, and my second show was about the experience of having my face turned into a meme. And so again, yeah, you're right. I hadn't really thought about that. There is a lot about the internet, and it does crop up. And I think it's because I have a complicated relationship with the internet and technology, because I love it. I listen to it. This show is one of a string of podcasts that I've listened to every single episode of. And, you know, I love Netflix, and I think it's amazing that we can share... You know, I'm into comedy that I would never have been able to access 10, 15 years ago. You know, a couple of clicks on YouTube and you're there. You can read essays and share information. But at the same time, I'm constantly worried that it's warping our brains negatively. So, yeah, there will be ambivalence towards technology, race, insecurity, long words, and some great swearing. I'm a good swearer.
I want to digress briefly because something has just occurred to me, which is that one of your strongest suits is a real sense of your own voice. And I don't mean, well, maybe I do mean the way in which people talk about, you know, finding one's voice as a comedian.
Sure.
But I think that you're very confident in your analysis and your presentation of yourself. Like,
sure.
And sometimes that takes the form of like, Kumar don't play that way, kind of thing, and that sort of pseudo, you know, Americanized, that sort of like lifting an existing
trope. That's right, yeah.
But also, like, several times during the show, you say things like, principled but cowardly, that's the Kumar way.
Yeah.
You know, you make pronouncements about yourself.
Yes.
And it strikes me that what you're describing about your complicated relationship with the internet is something that everybody feels with the internet.
Yeah.
Everyone has a complicated relationship with the internet. Something I really struggle to do, and that I think you have a really good facility for, is to say, I'm like this. This is my experience.
Yeah.
Whereas I often find myself going, oh, I can't say that because everyone thinks that, you know. But you seem very kind of comfortable. It's a real strength of yours that you go, this is my experience of the world. You have a great deal of ownership of your sentiments, of the sentiments that you pronounce.
Sure.
You make pronouncements about yourself and about the world.
Yeah.
Where does that confidence come from?
Because I am only ever expressing my opinion. And I try to make it clear the whole time that I'm only ever expressing my opinion. And that's something I'm interested in doing, but it's also the byproduct of... it's necessity is the mother of invention. And I tried for many years to relate to people as a comedian and try to do material that would resonate with people. And I was trying to say, don't we all do this and don't we all do that?
Like what? What sorts of things?
I was trying to do... I would try and do stuff about the way that, you know, British identity or, you know, we're all... I tried to expand what I was doing outwards because I thought for years when I wasn't... when it wasn't successful, I thought it's because, you know, people don't relate to me. Because I started from a position of going, this is my worldview and the rest of you can go fuck yourself. And then it didn't work for a while. So I thought, well, maybe I should expand it outwards. And on Josh Widdicombe's podcast, he talked a lot about how observational comedy is incredibly difficult. And he...
Oh, on his, yeah, his episode with this show,
We're now reaching a point where you've done enough shows that people are able to refer back to previous episodes. If you haven't had the reading list for this podcast, you're going to find it very difficult. But in Josh's podcast, Josh talked about how it was very difficult to do observational comedy. And it's a real... it seems a real bugbear of his that people think it's very easy to do. Largely because I've spent my entire friendship with Josh telling him what he does is easy. It's very easy to do. Oh, we all sit on a chair, don't we, Josh? He is correct. It's incredibly difficult to produce material that resonates with an audience and you can have that moment of shared recognition where they hit on something and people go, yeah, we all relate to that. I simply cannot do that. I would love to be able to do that, but I simply cannot do that. And sometimes the best, the most shrewd analysis on you comes from your own mother. And I once said to my mum must have been saying something like, why can't you do Michael McIntyre's stand-up show? Why don't you look at what he does? People like what he does. And I was trying to explain to her that he does observational comedy, and that's not a genre of comedy I do. And she said, yeah, well, of course you don't. You are not an observant man. And that is the most salient. I can't do comedy. I can't do a piece of material where I go, we all do this, don't we? For some reason, I don't have that club in my bag. I don't have that technical skill. And I am always much stronger. And I go over better with audiences when I go, this is my opinion. And this is what I feel about this. And I do this thing. And when I stop trying to get the audience to relate to me, my gig started going much, much better. Because I found that people either go, hey, I think that too, and I didn't think anyone else thought that. Yes. Or they go, you're fucked, mate. So yeah. Either way, people laugh because they either recognise it or it's so left field that they find it funny.
Absolutely. There's no element of your show whereby you're going, right, guys?
Yeah, because I can't do it. And the only reason I don't do it is because I have found through failure that I cannot do it. I just don't, my brain doesn't work in that way, and I'm not that type of comic. You know, there's so many different types of comic, but very often the sort of two broadest categories you can put people in are either people who are individuals that people find themselves laughing at or with, and that can be anything from, you know, somebody like Stuart Lee, who's presenting a very distinctive worldview and a series of opinions, or Milton Jones, or James Acaster, who is an odd person and is presenting themselves as an outsider. Or you get people who are, they're almost like politicians in that they're just geniuses of capturing the zeitgeist or saying something that resonates with an audience. And again, that is a sort of broad brushstrokes to do it with, but it tends to be people who are either like outsiders looking in and the audience is either laughing at or with them, or these kind of people who have a preternatural ability to judge the mood and verbalise what groups of people are thinking. So somebody like Michael McIntyre or somebody like Josh, you know, could easily turn those skills a couple of notches to the right and be Prime Minister, because they have this capacity to write stuff and perform stuff in a way where people go, wow, yeah, we all do that. That's, you know, those are incredible.
Yes, if you seeded a Prime Ministerial speech with some of Josh or McIntyre's observations,
I really
they'd be doing that thing like when on a cartoon when a smell goes past and your nose carries it along. Yeah.
I really believe that, you know, in a different world, Britain is ruled in a military junta by Michael McIntyre. Like, because I think that there are lots of different types of comics, but broadly you can almost put people into two broad camps.
So which are you?
I have always sat more comfortably as an outsider or as somebody just presenting their perspective and then letting that be judged.
So this is Nish, and as you can hear from this interview, no doubt, we get along famously. Nish is a good friend of mine and a brilliant comic, and it's very exciting for me to be able to use this show to support newer people on the circuit that are, as you can hear, just kind of starting to break through at the moment and really get the recognition they deserve. That process will continue at the Soho Theatre this January from Monday the 12th to Saturday the 17th. That's January. Nish Kumar is doing his show Ruminations on the Nature of Subjectivity at the Soho Theatre in Soho in that London. So go along and see him. Book your tickets now. I'm sure it's going to sell really well. And why not flood them with so many requests for tickets that they chuck on an extra week? Why not do that for lovely Nish? He's fantastic. I really, really recommend him. I know there's almost a sort of minor conflict of interest when I have someone on the show who's clearly my friend. But hey, there's people out there who are my friends that aren't good enough to be on the show. I'm looking at you, Comedian X. I'm teasing. There's an element of truth to that. And there's also an element of complete bullshit. My point is, just because he's my friend, don't discount him. Nish is superb. While we're advertising things, the three-headed megapod, a little Christmas megapod with this show and Carl Donnelly and Chris Martin's podcast, which is, we've talked about this now, it's going to be a really special event. We're not just going to take turns and do an hour each. We're going to combine all three in a big, all three of us, all two shows and all three people in a big, stupid Christmas affair with all sorts of items and kind of bits from, what are they called? What do you call an item on a show? Format. All kinds of format things. Don't know much about my job, but that's going to be great. Remember, at the Phoenix, which is a pub in Cavendish Square, just off Oxford Street in London, on December the 21st at 7 o'clock. So please get a ticket for that. You can Google up where to get them. It's on Twitter. It's on the Facebook page as well. The Twitter is, of course, as you know by now, at ComComPod. So you can check that out. Now, listen, I'm clearly wheezing again in the background, and it's been pointed out to me in passing by two people in the last week that I always see by the bunged up or wheezing when I'm doing the links. In fact, I've not stopped coughing since Dubai. And perhaps I'm on the way out. I'm starting to worry about it. This will be scary when it turns out in the future that I died of something horrible and lung related. This is my message back from the future. Just know that I loved you all. And it's dark here. This is getting morbid. I'm just worried. Whoa. I mean, Nathan, normally I ask you. Nathan is my brilliant co-producer, Nathan Wood. I occasionally talk to him, although I get him to cut those bits out when he edits this stuff together for me, for us. But let's leave this one in, Nathan. Just me telling you that, hey, don't cut that cough out. I know you've been cutting a lot of coughs out, but leave that one in just as part of my morbid fantasy about a message back from the future. It's interesting, the idea of legacy, isn't it? I'll be able to listen to these shows when I'm old and becoming gently demented. I've cleverly created an archive of conversations I've had with people I like and respect. And hopefully in the future, MP3s still exist and they can be beamed directly into your mind with added smells and sounds and so forth. And I'll get to enjoy all of these. That'll be mostly the... Have I said this before on the show? This is exactly my point. My lung capacity is diminishing. My mental capacity is diminishing. I've been worried for a while that I've got the memory of a little old lady because I keep going to the supermarket and seeing things I buy, and I have a very limited scope of things I buy, and I go, oh, that's green pesto, I get that, so I put it in my basket, and then I take it home and I open the cupboard and I've got seven identical jars of green pesto, and that's sort of what I imagined my granny doing when she was a bit more mobile, just buying the same thing over and over again, blissfully unaware of whether you've bought it. Whenever I've been in flat share situations, I've always wanted, and I've never done this because you don't want to be the sort of person that writes on your stuff in a flat share fridge, but I want to write on my stuff not to stop other people from having it, but to remind me that it's mine so that I don't. Otherwise, it's just a fridge full of stuff. And I look at things, I go, genuinely, I can't tell if any of this is mine. And I'm not just on the rob. I don't know whether any of it's legitimately mine because my mind is addled and failing. And I spoke to my manager. I had a lovely lunch with my manager last week. And she made reference to, just in passing, she said something about, yeah, we need to make sure we don't work you too hard, Stu, because you tend to get ill a lot, don't you? And I was thinking, do I? Oh, God, do I? I'm really worried about my wheezy lungs. I think I'm allergic to something in my house and I don't know what it is. And so I keep replacing things, taking things out and then replacing them. Have I told you that? This is becoming surreal. I'll get back to the plugs. Thank you for all of the love about the 100th show. Thank God these podcasts have got numbers. I can keep some record of where I am without going too mental. I had some lovely messages from you all, from loads of you, about the next, about the previous 100 shows. This is from James, who says, thanks, Stuart. The show inspired me to finally give stand-up a try, and it's exactly a year today. Thanks, he says, for the sleepless nights, lonely car journeys, and crippling anxiety. Here's to the next 100, James. Thank you, James. I'm just spreading the love. I'm just spreading the love, the lack of sleep, the loneliness and the crippling anxiety. So I'm glad you're enjoying all of that. Hopefully I'll also be spreading some lung-related infections and some loss of memory. Also, congratulations, says Roger Clark, on getting to 100. It's helped change my life over the last couple of years. Thank you, Roger. Roger's a firm friend and supporter of the show, so thanks to Roger. Erin Barton says, as an open spot who's performed stand-up for only a few months, it's both refreshing and terrifying to know there is no right or wrong way to write material. Well, my work here is done, Erin Barton. Glad you're enjoying it. And thank you to Helen Donoghue as well for a very sizable donation, which she qualified by pointing out the exact system that she used to work out what she felt like she should give. I shan't embarrass Helen by telling you the amount, but it was X pence per show plus something for the extra shows plus the £2 she never got round to donating during Edinburgh. Thank you, Helen. It's very much appreciated. You too can donate to keep me alive and buy me an iron lung. You can donate by going to comedianscomedian.com and clicking on the PayPal button, which is very easy to find and highly visible. You can go to patreon.com/comcompod if you're a Patreon user and donate however much money you think the show is worth. And remember, your donation pays for the people that can't afford it. I think a pound a show is more than fair, but equally, 25p a show is kind of a sort of mates rates thing, and we're all friends here. So just chuck at me whatever you think the show's worth if it's made a bit of a difference to your life. Me and my increasingly beleaguered team of quasi-staff members will thank you for it very much. Dave McSavage coming up in the next episode, a brilliant street performer, and apparently someone that a comic that people in Ireland love to hate. Have a watch of The Savage Eye, his sketch series. You can get that on YouTube if you're not in Ireland. I think they're now on their fourth season. To find out what we're talking about, have a little research of Dave before we speak to him in next week's episode, which is going to be recorded live tomorrow night in Dublin. There's also a great clip of Dave McSavage's old street show at Temple Bar. Yes, he used to be a street performer too, so pop that in the Google. That is all for now. Let's get back to Nish. Sorry it's been a bit rambling, but as I've explained, I am very old and falling apart both mentally and physically.
So this is a piece of material that I thought I would work as an observation. So a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to... I don't know why I'm pussying around saying his name. I was talking to James Acaster about an idea that I had for a joke, and he said, yeah, that'll really work as an observation. And it was the idea that... So the way that I presented it on the three or four occasions that I've done it was, guys, you know when you buy a new toothbrush, don't you hate it the way that you immediately lose your memory of your previous toothbrush. And the audience were just like, no! We know exactly what our previous toothbrush looked like. Are you an idiot?
That's very funny.
And I really thought, this is my man drawer. I really thought to myself, this is my man drawer. This is my Apollo set in white.
Oh my
just
god.
Just the audience went, no. And people then laughed. The time it worked was when I was talking about the failures of my own brain.
Yes.
And I said, I've got a terrific memory for pointless facts, but I have a very scattered, basic memory for day-to-day stuff. So I can tell you chronologically by date the order of Bob Dylan's 1960s album releases, but I can't remember what my last toothbrush looked like. And I did an act out off the back of that of my flatmate coming out with four toothbrushes saying, whose are these? And me going, I have absolutely no idea. And it worked much better when it was me presenting it. And I don't know why.
So let's look at that. What have you done there? You've taken it from being a, hey guys, we all think this.
Yeah.
Into an observation about your own life.
Yeah.
Which other people are free to agree with or not.
Or not.
If they haven't observed that themselves, they can go, look at this idiot.
So the material is not fully working yet, so I don't know whether it's something that will be... It's a new bit that's in a state of flux. But the times I've done it, and the times that it's worked, the audience has been divided, I would say, 70-30. 70% of the audience laughing at me, and 30% of the audience being pointed at by the person they're sat next to, as I say it, and they normally have their head in their hands. So,
what you've hit upon there is the genre of micro observational comedy, things that exactly 30% of the audience does.
I'm carving out a career as an observational comedian whose observations are so niche, his career is financially unsustainable. I think I've ended up being considered an interesting alternative comedian by default, just through an inability to do anything else.
Do you feel that the stuff you're doing now is the style that you're doing now is that you've got it, and this is the stuff you're going to be doing in 5, 10, 15 years' time? I don't mean, obviously, the material. I mean, this particular, like you say, those quarters, you know, family, internet, ethnicity.
Yeah.
And not only those topics, but also the way that you talk. You talk very fast. You cram in sort of 30% more punchlines into an hour than anyone else because you just continually talk very, very fast.
Yeah. I'm happy with what I did with this show, and I'm happy with the style that I hit on, and it's kind of evolved over the three solo shows, and I'm happy with, but I think it's, you never know where you're going to be in 5, 10 years time. You never know what kind of act you might be, and because when I did my first show, I thought, yeah, this is it, I've nailed it. You know, you have a tendency, wherever you arrive at...
You need that belief. You need, yeah, when you're putting your first hour together, you have to believe it's the answer to comedy.
You have to. And also, I think you slightly need that belief for every single thing that you do. I feel like every new thing that I'm working on is the best thing that I've ever done. And sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's a sort of necessary delusion. Just to sort of keep you pushing through it, you need to think, what I'm doing now is the greatest thing I've ever achieved. And then as soon as you're finished with it, like my second show, I was like, I don't know how I'm ever going to write a better show than this. This is my best show. Great. And then as soon as I was finished with it, I would say the day after the last show I did of it in Melbourne, I was like, thank fuck I don't have to do that again. For me, comedy, stand-up material has like a shelf life. I think that after a certain point, it starts to go a bit overripe. And so it's like shedding skin. Like, I think you just have to constantly go, I think this is the best thing ever. Nish, it's finished. Great, that was a piece of shit. And move on to whatever the next
thing. Yes, you can't be a mountain climber by climbing one mountain and then resting, like, telling everyone about it for the next 30 years of your career.
Yeah, sure.
You've got to go out and climb another fucking mountain.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I think some of that, you have to sort of slightly play tricks on yourself. You have to, at the time, think that what you're doing is great. And then as soon as you're done, you almost have to have slightly overcompensate either way. So when you're doing it, you have to think, this is really great. And as soon as it's done, you have to go, this is a piece of shit. And you and it's slightly too far the other way. The truth is, the show was probably, my second show was somewhere in between. It was a good show. It wasn't the best show I've ever done, but it wasn't as bad as I immediately felt about it after I'd finished with it. And some of that is just like, it just gives you the push to move on to the next thing.
Something I thought was really interesting about your most recent show, about Ruminations, is that it did contain, it seemed to contain more than the previous two shows. It contained more of your kind of self-analysis and your analysis of your own emotional foibles, stumbling blocks, things like that. You talked a lot about your ego, you talked about convincing, I thought it was very, very funny that you, having been single for 7 years, you'd convinced yourself you had a certain personality simply by telling yourself you had that personality.
Yes.
So what was it like, the experience to write? Was it different to write observational comedy about, like, where you stand outside yourself and observe your, whether it's observational or not, you stand outside yourself and you kind of analyse and assess and sort of forensically cut into your own emotions?
Yeah.
Was that, what was the difference between that process and writing the sort of stuff you have where you're telling a story about something that happened on a train?
Found it more rewarding because I just felt like it was more personal.
Was it harder to write?
Yes, it was harder to make work. It wasn't necessarily harder to write. Like, I had the ideas and I had the pieces in place, and I felt like, oh, okay, I have the jokes lined up. And so actually what you see in the show is very similar to what was initially written. All of the material that's about my ego and my pessimism, the actual words are pretty much the same as the first time I did it. It's hard to make work on stage because I think people almost were over-empathising and feeling sorry for me. And it wasn't, it was hard to function as comedy because it felt particularly like, it was really hard to make that work. It wasn't hard to write, it was hard to make funny on stage. So I'm trying to, let me sort myself out because I think, I'm not sure I'm explaining this clearly. I found it very easy to write that material, to analyse myself and to write jokes about my own weaknesses. But when it came to performing them on stage to people, I found it hard to get laughs because people were feeling sorry for me or were almost like, oh God, this guy really has problems. And from my perspective, I was going, no, this is funny. Like, it's funny to me, but it's because I wasn't performing it right. So it's easy to write, but it was hard to perform.
Do you, it's interesting, what that throws up for me is that if you write a joke and you go, this is easy to write this joke, and then you tell that joke and people don't laugh at it, have you written a joke?
Yeah, if a tree falls in a forest on someone's head and no one laughs at them, I haven't really thought about that. I think I had an instinct that it would work. I had an instinct. Like, it must have worked enough of the time initially. It must have worked 50-50. Or maybe even, I think actually from memory, it didn't even work 50-50. It was working one every three or four times. But when it worked, it really worked.
Yeah.
So it's that thing of going, because normally when you get in, most of the material, particularly the material in this show, most of it was like stuff that I would do and people would laugh at some of it and not other bits of it, and you'd edit it and prune it. But that section about myself particularly, people would either laugh at all of it or none of it.
Yeah.
But when they got it, it got an amazing, it got a really good response, and it was a really exciting thing. So I sort of thought it's worth persisting with, because if it's going, this must be something I'm doing on one night out of four that's making it work, but I'm not doing the other three nights, because it was working so well and I felt so good about it on the one night it was working. The three nights it wasn't working, I was thinking, maybe I'm doing something wrong. And I slowly realised that I was doing something wrong. It was a performance trick that I wasn't doing. And it's about changing the tone of... I found it easier to perform material that might be more political or more personal if I get silly in my performance.
Aha! I was hoping you'd say that, yeah. Because the next...
I just found that I've got sillier and looser in the way that I perform on stage, and that has given me a license to talk about more serious subject
matter. I'm really excited to hear you say that, and I'm not trying to take any credit for this, but yeah. I've been telling you to be sillier for ages.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We had that conversation more than a year ago.
Yeah.
When I was like, the way you are socially, when you're just really daffy and this guy and all the rest of it, I think is your funniest self.
Yes.
And for me, I was always fascinated by the dynamic between that and the really intelligent stuff you'd say on stage.
Yeah.
I thought that bit was the strongest bit of your show when you were talking about yourself, because you were using your sort of forensic analysis abilities to take yourself apart.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I thought that was my favourite bit.
But you can do the... And what I found is, if you do the forensic analysis bit, but you do it in quite a sort of, you know, serious way, people obviously take it seriously.
Yes.
And the reason that that material was working once out of four times is I was much looser with it and much more goofy on stage.
Yes.
And people realising that it was a joke. And so, and that was like, that's been the biggest breakthrough, I think, for me in stand-up in the last 12 months, is I've realised if I'm goofier and sillier, I can talk about anything. I can interpret survey data for 10 minutes. 10 minutes of my show is interpreting survey data. And it's a very
strong bit as well. Just for people listening, it's an exploration of the data is what exactly?
The data is a survey that said a third of people would not
would be uncomfortable
with the idea of a non-white prime minister in the UK.
Yeah.
And immediately I was like, this is a really interesting thing.
And it's a very you thing as well. You're like, this is me. This is data and ethnicity. It's the internet and ethnicity. Yeah, it's part of the holy triangle.
Exactly.
If only my dad had taken the survey.
If only I'd gone to see a dirty movie with my dad, that dirty movie with my dad is a reference to a piece of material from my first show.
Yeah,
I didn't realise if you leave that hanging and don't know the context, it sounds alarming. I was able to interpret survey data and just talk about that, but in a goofy way. And two things have happened. One, it's enabled me to talk about and do material that I don't think I would have been capable of talking about 12 months ago. And two, it's done the thing that I think in a weird way I've always wanted to do, which is one of the things that I was most, I guess, jealous of, but one of the things I aspired most to was I heard an interview with Richard Lewis. He's an American comedian, American stand-up comedian, and he's in Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's Larry David's friend. And he said, I mean, he's been doing comedy for 50 years now, something ridiculous like that. And he said that he now is so, the gap has dropped to such an extent between his personality and his onstage persona that he now doesn't write anything down. He has a list of words that he is going to talk about, and he goes on stage and he talks about them. And I remember thinking, I would love to do that.
Yeah.
I would love the gap between my offstage personality, my real personality, and my onstage personality to thin to such an extent. There's always going to be elements of yourself that you dial up and down on stage because it's a performance. It would be a cheat to just turn up and speak as you, like I'm like an evening with Nish Kumar. It would be a cheat almost to do that. So you've got to have some performance skills. But I'm very jealous of people. I personally love the idea of going on stage and being myself. And I've been searching and trying to thin that gap.
It's almost the Tai Chi of comedy, isn't it? It's like, it's the moment when you kind of, the this some sort of Zen moment happens when you're like, oh, I'm no longer pushing nor pulling.
Yeah. Well, it's seeing the Matrix.
Yeah. And there's only, I mean, last week's episode, I don't know if you've heard it with Phil Kay, he talks about the moment when the bullets no longer are appropriate. which incidentally is the best way anyone's ever described that moment.
Yeah, and Phil Kay is so fearless. I get the impression if someone actually shot him on stage, those bullets would be appropriate. I honestly believe if somebody shot Phil Kay in the middle of a stand-up set, he would wave his hand and the bullet would just fall away. But, yeah, and again, I think I'm always very wary of people who say a thing that they think about stand-up and what they want to do with stand-up and go, that's what stand-up's about.
Sure.
It's about honesty and about truth, and that's what stand-up's about. That's bullshit. It's just that's my
ambition. It's like saying that's what weather's about.
Yeah, really, one of the things, as a student of this podcast,
well, that phrase is going to get repeated. You're the originator.
One of the things that I think comes up constantly is people have a bugbear or a particular axe to grind, and sometimes they don't even realise that they're grinding it until they talk about it on this podcast. And you'll see, like, or people, often you hear interviews go, God, that actually really bothers me. The thing that bothers me, I think, most about stand-up is whenever people say, that's what stand-up is. That's what being a real comic is. Because stand-up is such a great, broad church. I mean, it's just a person and a microphone. You could do anything. Why would you restrict it to being that one thing? So whenever people say it's about questioning people in power, you go, I mean, are you saying Emo Phillips is not a comedian?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
He goes on stage and makes jokes up in chess with old people, like, and Stephen Wright and Tony Law and the silly rant. And then at the same time, people who go, you know, comedy is all about, it's all about just purely making an audience laugh. You go, well, does that mean you're invalidating Lenny Bruce or Stuart Lee? You know, there's no one thing. Stand-up is whatever you want it to be.
I wonder why people come to those conclusions. I wonder if it's because it is such a broad church, it's so open, that people feel they need to tie themselves to one mast or another.
Maybe. I think also there is sometimes a sense of people who are high on their own self-importance. You know, I think sometimes people want to, I think probably your interpretation is a more charitable view of people than mine. But I think sometimes people get carried away with their own significance, and they have a tendency to go, what I'm doing must be correct stand-up.
And we might extrapolate then, if you don't have a problem, if your problem is with people who have an axe to grind about a particular thing, do you not have an issue with your self-importance? Are you a kind of, like, I mean, you don't seem to be...
I mean, every stand-up has a certain amount of self-importance. You have to have a certain level of self-importance to stand up and go, everyone here, I can't remember, Alfie Brown has a great line about it. I think it's something like, and I apologise if I'm mangling this, but Alfie said something like, I think I'm such good company, I charge.
Yeah.
And it's like a perfect line about stand-up, I think.
Yes.
So there is a base level
absolutely, but specifically about you. Like, I get the sense of, and you know, I like to ask people if they're happy or not. But interestingly, in your most recent show, you talked about the problems with your ego and thinking you were great, and then being optimistic and actually realizing you were pessimist.
Yeah.
Are you happy?
Yes, I think so.
You seem to be at the height of your powers, operating in an industry you believe in which you believe, and with an ability in which you believe.
Yeah.
And you seem to, I mean, I wonder if that's why you don't have an axe to grind, other than about people who have an axe to grind.
Yeah, but I mean, there's always a presentational self, and then there's your actual self. And there's always, Josh Widdicombe said that I'm the happiest man he knows. And I think my problem is sometimes,
come on, do it.
I think sometimes I have a problem verbalising my frustrations and my neuroses and all of the negativity is something that is very present in my head, and I struggle to verbalise it. And this show was both a breakthrough, I think, comedically for me, but I think it was also quite something of a personal breakthrough, to use therapy language, in that I think I really got into the core of some of my issues that I have. And I am a happy person, but I also have a tremendous ego. Just because I'm self-aware of it and I say I have a tremendous ego doesn't solve that problem. So if you have a tremendous ego, it's fine, and it can be really good because it pushes you up on stage and, you know, makes you a good communicator. But at the same time, if you have a tremendous ego, there's always going to be a part of you that goes, I'm not doing as well as I should be. Or I'm not as successful as I should be. And I'm not, you know, I should be better. And again, that can be a good thing, because the impulse to say I should be better is something that can motivate you. But at the same time, it can drag you down. It can make you benchmark arbitrarily against other people.
And do you do that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
that's not obviously you. That's not a thing that you ever express to me.
But it's very difficult to, because it's very embarrassing to talk about your. It's very embarrassing for me to talk about my personal failings. And for some reason, until I'm faced with a group of strangers, at which point it's very easy for me to say anything. If somebody will get a laugh, I'm like, yeah, I'll tell them that aspect of my personality. No problem. It got a laugh. And it. So yeah, there is all of that stuff, but it's I don't. It's not as foregrounded with me, which is, I think people sometimes, it cuts both ways. So that's both sort of a good thing, because I think I'm a great laugh and I'm good company. I'm a tremendous laugh.
You are a great laugh.
I'm a tremendous laugh, but I think it's a bad thing because there's a level of dishonesty going on. Like, I'm not as open about my flaws in my personal life, I think, as I should be, because I think it's healthy to be aware of your limitations, because then I think you can actually go about managing them better.
Which comes first for you, the wanting to get a laugh or the wanting to say a thing? Like, when you're sitting, like, you we were just talking earlier on, you're planning, you're thinking you're going to do Edinburgh next year.
Sure.
And when sitting down to write an Edinburgh show,
yeah.
if that's even a sort of worthwhile sentence, you know, something I find myself thinking, and I have of late sort of realised this probably isn't a great way to look at it. I find myself thinking, Christ, I've got to fill an hour. Do you know what I mean? There's an element of that. And really what I'm trying to do now is, no, I need to do is be excited by a thing and want to explore it.
Yeah.
Up until such time as I have to sadly stop that process and go, no, I've been excited about too many things now. Those are all the things I have
right, okay,
to talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah,
do you know what I mean? There's like coming at it from two different
angles. Yeah, I wonder whether there's anyone, any comedian who's in, you know, September or February or whenever you make the decision to go to Edinburgh thinks, God, I've just got too many ideas. If only there was a way for me to winnow down my genius. I wonder whether there's anyone. I think there's lots of people, even like some of the most exciting and creative people I know, have moments where they go, oh, fuck, I've got to fill in. I think even, like, it's weird because it's a strange job to do, because some of the people you know are the best people at doing a thing. And it's good sometimes to occasionally talk to them and they go, oh, Christ, I've really got to fill this out. Yeah. And I think it's easy to think everyone else is going, oh man, I've got too much stuff. I've already started writing 2017's
sure.
Edinburgh show. I've got
sure, sure, ideas. Sure.
Whereas I think actually everyone is kind of going, oh shit.
But which comes first? Do you think, hang on a minute, this thing I'm thinking could get a laugh? Or do you think, I really want to say this thing I'm thinking?
This thing I'm thinking would get a laugh.
You do think with that way around. I'm relieved to hear that, because I think in those terms, and then I catch myself and I go, no, Stu, that's not the right way round. You're supposed to be thinking about expressing
again
yourself.
I think that the phrase the right way round is again an odd one, just because I think you just got to find a working method that's comfortable for you. if you look at all of the people who have talked about the way that they write, there's like five different ways. Some people write word for word. Some people make notes. Some people use a recorder. And similarly, I think some people would start from a perspective of going, I want to do a show about this. Like, I would say someone like, this may be again me speaking out of turn, but I'd say someone like Sarah Pascoe. I'm very, again, envious of her, because it feels like sometimes she goes, I am interested in talking about this, so I'm going to get a grips with it and I'm going to make it funny. And I think that that's what makes her a really exciting comic. But it's just not something I'm comfortable doing. I'm comfortable working it the other way around, which is thinking about something and going, oh, hey, that might be funny.
So let's talk about your process then. How do you start? What are your starting points? And I sort of, we've written together in the past in cafes, so I sort of know this, but you know, this is the fucking show, isn't it?
I would start with some like half-baked things. The reason my shows, I don't think necessarily I set out with a statement to go, this show is going to be about subjectivity or economics, and it's going to have a reference to this essay that I read and this survey. It's just those are the things that interest me, and so those, I'm interested in politics and opinions, and you know, I'm interested in that kind of stuff in my day-to-day life, and so that's what's going round in my head when I'm walking around, in, you know, just walking around thinking about all of that kind of stuff, because I and it's just kind of cycling. And
I'm only smiling now because I'm realizing that what's going on in my head when I'm walking around is me, which well, is why all of my shows are me.
But that's great. That's like, that's, yeah, you should be proud of that and own that, because that's a lot of great comedy comes from people walking around going me. If Mark Maron brings out an hour where he starts it by going, guys, I've just realised there's a lot of suffering going on in the world and none of it's mine, everyone would be like, what the fuck is this? Maron, we want to see you suffer. Yeah, I think so that's all the stuff that's going through my head. And also there is a huge amount of me going on in the background as well. And so that, I'm interested in a subject. So the whole of this show basically started from an idle conversation I had while I was doing a gig in Edinburgh, like a free fringe gig, and there were about 11 or 12 people there, and I did it because the people who run it are really nice, and I was talking to the audience. It was fun, you know. When you're doing Edinburgh, sometimes you get bogged down in the show, and it's fun sometimes to go and do material that isn't your show. It's very strange to be relaxing by doing more of your job. Very strange, but it definitely helps me. I like going and doing a set to 10 people and not doing anything that I'm doing in my show. And I was doing this gig, and there was a girl in the front row who I was talking to, and there was a couple, nice young couple in the front row, and I was talking to them, and it was weird sort of conversation. And this girl was wearing a T-shirt that had Bazinga on it, which I did not recognise. So I asked her what it was. She said, it's from The Big Bang Theory, in a way that was like, you must be kidding me. How do you not know this? And she said, it's from The Big Bang Theory. And I said, do you like the show? And she said, well, obviously, I've got a T-shirt. And I said, I fucking hate that show. And she laughed. And because there was sort of quite a good convivial atmosphere, everyone laughed. And I thought, it made me think, it's quite funny that I resent people who don't enjoy my comedy. But at the same time, I hate The Big Bang Theory. And that the whole show started from the position of me going, I don't like The Big Bang Theory, so I am sympathetic to Big Bang Theory fans who may not like my comedy.
Yeah!
And then the whole thing kind of bounced off that. And that's just because I am interested in the idea of people's opinion, and, you know, and I'm interested in the way that you verbalise your opinion. And, you know, I was a fucking debater at school. I read comment and analysis and blogs until I'm blue in the face. And I'm interested in the way that people express their opinion. So that's just stuff that goes around my head, like on a day-to-day basis. So, and then the material, because what I find is if it churns around in my head for long enough, a weigh-in will come in that I can write comedy about it. But I wouldn't say that I set... I never at any point thought I'll write a show about subjectivity and opinion. Yes. It's just that happened to be what I was thinking about for a while. And then when I said I hate the Big Bang Theory and a Big Bang Theory fan laughed, I thought, right, that's funny.
Yeah.
Because comedy is such a taste-driven thing.
Sure.
That it seemed like an interesting way in to all of those issues that I'd been thinking about the way that people express opinion and... I'm constantly looking for a way in to talk about things that interest me. But I would only go start talking about it once I found that way in. Because I'm a stand-up. I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
I want... My job is ultimately to make...
Oh, is that what you are?
Sometimes the lines have felt blurred. Sometimes, some gigs, I come off stage and go, oh, I mean, that was an A-level essay. Just read out an A-level essay, basically.
This is the next question. Do you lose interest in things if you can't make them funny, or do they stay there being a thing that you're interested in, that you're trying to write about, that isn't working?
Sometimes you have to let stuff go and admit that...
Can you give us an example of one? I'm always fascinated to hear what stuff's been excised or removed or has kind of sputtered and died along the way.
There's so much stuff that I've just had to jettison because it... just never really... people would just sort of agree with it as a good point. I think there's a lot of stuff about... there was a lot of stuff about economics that I was talking about and capitalism that I managed to boil down into one joke, but that I was talking around quite a lot. And people were going, yep, so these are very salient points about financial inequality. It's not fucking comedy, mate.
What was the line?
There wasn't like a line that I had to drop. Okay. It was a series of ideas about the unfairness of the global financial system. I didn't now say it out loud. You go, of course that wasn't funny. But I managed to boil it down. I managed to find one joke about it, that's in the show. But then there was a lot of talking around it. And I sort of thought, right, this will be really interesting. A better example is the piece of material in my show about insomnia. So I have trouble sleeping. And I've ended up with like a 2.5 minute chunk about insomnia. But there was a lot of stuff around that about why I can't sleep and, processing all of the information that's happened in a day and your brain kind of stopping you from sleeping by bringing up issues that, again, was interesting, but it wasn't funny. And so it was about winnowing down. I would say it's very rare that a whole topic goes.
Yes.
But what inevitably will happen is it just gets thinned down. And all the stuff that is interesting but not funny gets boiled down into something that is funny. That, for me, just because there's a danger with my style of the whole thing lapsing into a lecture. I constantly have to remind myself, you just need to keep the punchlines coming in. You need to keep the punchlines coming in.
It must be quite... that almost seems, it's the way... my psyche works, as we know. I'm going, God, I'd love it if my stuff, when it wasn't funny, it was at least interesting. when my stuff isn't funny, there's a danger it lapses into a man saying things.
We're all in danger of, disappearing up our own backsides. Either if it's, because you're talking about yourself and it's just a person talking about themselves, or if you're just saying, guys, these are my opinions. People are just going, well, I don't give a shit, mate. Tell a fucking joke.
Do you read reviews?
Obsessively.
Do you?
Obsessively. I would say that's the worst thing I do. Like, that's the most...
Yeah, for a happy, confident, interested, politically active kind of guy.
It's unhealthy emotionally, but also it's very self-indulgent. If you're reading a bad review, it's unnecessary masochism. And if you're reading a good review, it's just...
disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting. If you take a position... like if I met me, sometimes I think I would just think, you need to sort your act out, mate. What are you doing? Why are you reading reviews? I do. I don't think it's healthy. But I do. I can't help myself.
You'll know one of my favourite questions on the podcast is, what piece of criticism most stung you? I try to... I've sort of... part of me feels like I should stay away from standard questions. And part of me's like, I've got one or two that I'm like, no, I'll chuck that in.
Yeah.
So forgive me if you've heard that one before.
What
thing hurt the most? Because obviously the next thought from that is, well, you know, the stuff that hurts the most, maybe that's the true stuff. You know?
Yeah, I think that there is. So there's an element of that. It wasn't necessarily a piece of criticism, but I have been asked a couple of times about the amount that I talk about race, and do I feel like it's a crutch that I'm leaning on? And that stung, but only because I feel like, only because there's obviously a part of me that feels like I talk about race too much. But then you have to go, if you actually go over, it's, you know, in this show, it's maybe about 15 minutes of an hour show. And then you also have to go, even individually, I'm happy with the content that I talked about. But I, for some reason, that really stung me. I don't fully know why. I think maybe it was the idea that it was, maybe I felt like it was a dig at me as a comedian, that I couldn't be funny unless I was incorporating my race into it. And it wasn't even necessarily a piece of criticism. It was just something I got asked repeatedly in interviews in India. I did some press stuff in India, and it was something that I got asked about quite a lot, and for some reason it did sting me. I would say I'm not fully sure why that is, but and then there's other, you know, when it's a publication you read outside, you know, in your general life, or if it's a reviewer, for example, that you, whose opinion you respect, and you get a review that isn't positive, that's hard. That's definitely hard. I would say the most nervous I've ever been about a review coming out was my Guardian review, because and it was, the review was good, which is fine, but I was terrified. I think, I'm not sure how emotionally ready I am to get a bad review from the Guardian, because I've been reading that paper since I was, you know, 13 or something. And I think it may even have been, I think Josie Long said something like, getting a bad review from The Guardian is like being told off by your parents. Mm. So I think it's, the reviews that sting can sometimes be if it's a publication you, or a critic who you have read in the past and whose opinion you value, and you go, yeah, this person knows what they're talking about. And then you read a negative review and you go, oh, God.
You presumably you're faced with a choice there, whether to stop believing that they know what they're talking about,
exactly,
because it no longer matches up with your worldview, or to say they know what they're talking about and therefore I must be bad.
Yeah, I think the problem, there's part of me that thinks, oh, you should never read any reviews. And then there's other parts of me that think, on occasion, like my Times review last year was from 2013, had quite a specific criticism in it that I think was actually quite helpful in a weird way. The reviewer said something about how I was maintaining that I was, in my last story, I described myself as being a nice lad trying his best. And in the review, it said, he says he's a nice lad trying his best, and he's kind of making out that he's just this humble guy. But he's also broadcasting opinions in quite a confident way, and it's something like I was underestimating the extent to which I am pushing my brain on people, and then also simultaneously trying to be like, hey, but I'm just a normal guy, regular guy like you.
Yeah,
and I would say that was actually quite helpful.
I think that's actually accurate.
I don't think it's a particularly, it's not a popular view amongst comics to defend reviewers. But yeah, it was the Times review of my second show, and I thought it was genuinely helpful, as a genuinely helpful point. And it was interesting to read about, it was interesting to read that and think, I agree with that, and it's something that I can sort of action positively. And it was helpful. I know it is, a lot of people, I will get some grief for this from some of my friends, but that review of my show, reading that review of my show, was helpful in moving forward. We're supposed to describe critics as the scum of the earth. I'm aware that's the party line,
But I think at the end of the day, anyone that... my issue with critics is that they are no more or less relevant than anyone else who's seen a lot of shows. And I think you can take on feedback from people. I think it doesn't matter whether they're a critic or whether they're your friend or whether they're another comic or your mum.
Yeah.
You can take feedback on from people.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that's right. But I think that if it's the job of a critic to elevate themselves above, because their job is peddling an opinion. So if you're going to, I think a good critic is somebody who is able to articulate their opinion with a clarity and also have, you know, because they're supposed to be students of the genre. So it's to have some kind of sense of the wider context, which isn't just, oh, this is a bit like the Mighty Boosh. Like,
yes.
you have to be like, so if you're interested, if you read somebody like Philip French, who was the film critic in The Observer, or... I particularly think Philip French, the film critic in The Observer, he's a great example of what good criticism involves. Because in theory, you're right, a critic is no different from just a person in the street. But their job is to have an opinion. So you have... I think good critics are people whose opinion doesn't necessarily count more, but good critics are people whose opinion are able to articulate their opinions clearly and write well, and that's what elevates their opinion, because they, in theory, should have a wider knowledge of the context and the genre and be able to appreciate things from a slightly different perspective, because we all use them. Like, I use film critics or music critics. There are people whose taste I trust because it aligns with my own and whose opinion I respect, even when...
And similarly, there are people who, if someone hates a thing, I'm probably going to enjoy it.
Yeah, there are, definitely. Yeah. And there are also people who even... So, like, I hated the movie Gone Girl. I hated it. But I read Peter Bradshaw's The Guardian film reviewer, and I read his review, and I thought, I respect that opinion. I disagree with it, but it's articulated well, so I respect that opinion. And that, to me, is what critics should be, setting themselves above the opinions of other people, because that's just their job. That's like us saying, comedians saying, somebody coming up to a comedian going, well, my friend is funny.
Why
should I bother paying to see you? And that's the thing with critics. It's like, I've got an opinion. Why should I pay to hear yours? And good critics do justify that.
Kumar stands up for the critics. This one's going to get retweeted. Listen, we must draw to a close. But before we do, you touched on it there, and you'll notice one of my notes there says poo / butt / clown.
Yeah.
We've kind of covered that earlier on.
Yeah.
You mentioned it earlier on, but you said in your show that someone in the industry had said to you, stop mentioning that you're Indian on stage. And obviously in the show that becomes a comic conceit of going, they're going to know. you're going to have to touch it. What was that specific bit of feedback? Was it stop mentioning that you're Indian so much? Was that the thing that you were talking about a moment ago? No.
I was advised... years ago now that I shouldn't talk about being Indian in my stand-up at all, because people were asked, so this is like probably 2008 2009, like I had a tough couple of years in comedy, and some of it was because I was being advised very poorly by a professional. And so this person told me that I should stop mentioning that I'm Indian on stage, and it really knocked me, because I sort of thought, oh, I don't really know. And then the piece of material becomes a ridiculous thing, but there is a core of truth to it, which was the same person who advised me to stop mentioning that I was Indian on stage then subsequently sent me in for an audition. It was an agent. There's no point in me messing around. Then sent me in for an audition where I was being asked to do an Indian accent. And I was so furious, and I was so offended, because to me, when I talk about my ethnicity on stage as a stand-up, I'm in control of the presentation of it, and I'm very careful to make sure that I'm not getting any Uncle Tom laughs. I spend a lot of time making sure that my material isn't something that a racist could laugh at by accident. You know, I don't want to sell out my cultural heritage in that way. I'm very keen to not do that. Whereas this was a script written by somebody else. It was me using my ethnicity to score cheap laughs in a way that what I felt sold out the Indian community in this country. And when I didn't want to do that, this person advised me, he basically told me that I'd have no future in comedy. And I would say that that whole experience, it was about 6-7 months, set me back a year because it really knocked my confidence. If you talk to people like David Trent and Ben Tarjay, they, amongst others, all have a good Kumar's quitting story. and so, it did really knock my confidence. There were a lot of times where I thought where I was going to pack it in because it was a really... And I think that piece of criticism particularly really stung me because, in your head you're going, but this person knows what they're talking about. And it took me about a year and a half to realise they don't know what they're talking about. This person was full of shit. In the long run, it helped me. Not just because I got 5 minutes closer to filling my hour this year.
Let's finish on a ComCom classic. What's the best piece of advice you've been given?
I've been given a lot of good advice.
I really thought you were pausing there because you were going to go, my ego is so big that I don't register advice.
Yeah, I've been given a lot of good advice by myself. I am my own best counsel. I feel like sometimes... I feel like I should be cooler, but I'm a huge comedy nerd. I think you would say... The people who come to see me, I would say the bracket that I've been put into of comedians, I'm probably the least interesting, formally, of the lot of them. But the comedy nerds that come out to see me, they would go and see, Tony Law and James Acaster and Josie Long and then me. And of that list, I would say I'm probably the least alternative and in some ways the least interesting. I believe that it's because the people who are watching me feel like one of us has got through. I think comedy nerds watch me and go, one of us made it. Good job, buddy.
That's so untrue, but so lovely to hear that.
So the pieces of advice that I've given are all things that I've collected from various interviews that I've read with comedians and various podcasts that I've listened to. There's a lot of good advice that's come on this podcast from various different people. Every couple of months, I listen to Aziz Ansari's Nerdist interview. And in that interview, he talks about a piece of advice he was given where he was doing something he was trying to get 5 minutes together for television. And this club owner said, don't worry about all of the industry stuff. Be undeniably funny. If you think what you're doing is funny and no one is picking up on it, do something funnier. Just constantly push yourself to be better and try not to think too much about the big picture. And by the time I heard that, that interview was probably about 18 months ago. And I feel like I had learnt that already, but through experience and realising that things only started going well for me when I stopped giving a shit about how they were going to go and just concentrated on writing good stuff and, constantly producing better stuff and getting better and better and better and not worrying about what agents had seen me or what TV people had seen me. That stuff is all a distraction. The best advice you can ever be given is be undeniably funny. And there's part of me that wishes someone had just sat me down in 2008 and just gone, don't think about agents. Don't think about television people. Don't worry. If you are good enough, they will come to you. Just concentrate on your material. And if you think your material is good and no one is coming to see you, do better material. And just the phrase, be undeniably funny, is the best piece of advice you can ever give anyone.
Thanks, Nish. So that was Nish. Thanks very much to him for being on the show. Do remember his show is on at Soho Theatre, Ruminations on the Nature of Subjectivity, which is from Monday the 12th of January to Saturday the 17th of January, early next year. Please do go and see that. Remember to come along to see Slightly Fat Features in Variety Soup at Leicester Square Theatre. I think we're going on the 15th, Monday the 15th of December. Pile in and get your tickets for that. That should be a lot of fun.
Thanks to Nathan Wood for co-producing this show. He did all the podmin himself, as did I for this one, so no pod gremlins to thank this time. That's everything, I think. At ComComPod on Twitter, info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to get in touch and suggest either some sort of brain training exercises, a means of tattooing things on my body so I stop forgetting what I've said all the time, or indeed allergy advice or CPR, or if you want to send me some oxygen by post, you can do that through the internet. Thanks, everybody. Dave McSavage coming up next week. I'm sure you're going to enjoy that. And thanks once more to Nish and to you for listening. Much appreciated. Share it with a friend. Give us a 5-star review on iTunes if you are strapped for cash. Speak to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.